Thanks, David. So that's right. Over this week, we've seen lots of new techniques for generating data at really large scales, at the scale of terabytes, as we're talking about, single images that are that big. And there's new techniques being developed as we speak to speed up the collection, to take it down from weeks of data collection, months of data collection, to maybe a few days. But the biggest problem, of course, as everyone's mentioned, is that the biggest bottleneck now is the analysis step. We can quickly generate the data, but now we have to process it and analyze it. And I'm going to talk here about analyzing it to generate connectivity maps or connectomes. This is something, again, you've heard of a lot during this week. So the basic computational problem can sort of be broken up into two steps. One step is to trace the wires between the neurons. So this is sort of a cartoon of a neural network. So what you'd like to do is kind of trace the wires, figure out which wire connected to which neuron, and then you have to find the synapses. So those are two steps that you could imagine automating and then connecting them up. And once you do that, you can make nice wiring diagrams like this. This neuron is connected to that one, and so on. Now, if neurons were all multicolored and the lines were all the wires were colored in different colors, this would be an easy problem. And there's a technique like BrainBow, so you could in the future might help us solve this problem. But for now, at the resolution that we care about, when we have dense labeling and we'd like to do dense connectomics, the only game in town is electron microscopy, and with electron microscopy, all neurons are kind of colored the same color, so you do actually have to trace through the jumble of neuropil to try to find which synapse is connected to which neuron. Okay, so of these two problems, so the tracing of wires, what does that mean in terms of the images? Again, you've sort of seen this before. What that means is you take an electron micrograph like this, and what you want to do is color the wires by kind of drawing contours and filling them out. And when you do that in 3D, you get to color a three-dimensional volume, which shows you which wire is which, and then locating synapses looks like this. You've seen this before. So of the two problems, tracing the wires is in some sense the harder problem in the sense that it's the least tolerant to errors. So what do I mean here? So in image segmentation, and I'll explain this a little bit more, local errors have global consequences. And in tracing neurons, there's many, many opportunities for local errors. So a typical neuron, different cell types have different numbers, but has about 20 millimeters of wire. And at the resolution that we're measuring this at, if you kind of look along the wire, how many pixels does it take to go from one end to the other? It's about a million pixels. So if you want to make less than one mistake per neuron, that means your error rate has to be less than one in a million. And that's an extraordinarily small error rate. In contrast, there's about just 10,000 synapses on average per neuron. And so these mistakes that you make over here are isolated in the sense that if you make one mistake that leads to a mistake of one synapse in the connectivity matrix, whereas if I make one mistake at an early stage along the dendritic tree, I could be screwing up the connectivity of tens, hundreds, maybe even thousands of downstream synapses along that branch. And so you really need to, A, there's a lot of places to make mistakes, and B, you need to solve this to a greater fidelity than the other problem. So what are the kinds of mistakes that happen? So one of the things that might happen is here's a segment of a neurite. What might happen is that due to resolution limitations, it might kind of narrow to a little bit, and you might have a break in the wire. So the automated output of your algorithm might give you something that looks like this. So it's colored millions of pixels on that side of it red, and millions of pixels on this side of it orange. And so what that means is that I've made just a small mistake over here of a few pixels. Just that small mistake has led to millions of pixels on either side being miscolored. So this local error has these long-range consequences. A second type of mistake that occurs in reconstructions is that you could take wires and you could sort of, at the place where they touch, you could merge them. And this kind of merge error leads to, again, millions of pixels on either side being miscolored. What you'd like is for this to be one wire, colored in one way, and this to be colored a different color. But right here, I've made a mistake of just a few pixels, and that's completely destroyed the segmentation. Sorry.
So both of these strike me as though, although it's very difficult to identify where the error occurs, it seems to be relatively straightforward to identify that any error has occurred. Because in one case, you have a segment of axon without a cell body, and in another case, you have a cell body.
That's exactly right. So you can use heuristics to discover that errors have occurred. Again, going back and, as you said, figuring out where that happens is a challenge. That's a challenge that's a problem that's relevant to when you're proofreading these things. You get an automated output, and you want to correct it. You want to figure out where that mistake was. So localizing mistakes is an important thing there. But localizing mistakes is also important if you're training an algorithm to fix its own mistakes. So that's exactly a crucial insight. So why do these things happen, though? So why are we making these mistakes? Let's take a small patch of an electron micrograph right here. That's about 6 by 6 pixels right here. And if I ask you, does this look like a boundary between cells? It's a little difficult to answer that question. You zoom out a little bit more, you look at more context, more pixels, still maybe not that clear. And now you're starting to see it again when you zoom out a lot more. And so what that means is just looking really locally, you can't really figure out what's going on. And frequently you might have to look and integrate information over a large field of view to figure out that what's going on is that there's these 5 cells. And there is, in fact, a boundary here, but there was either a gap in the stain or a little bit of noise that's led to this boundary being indistinct locally. But when you look over a larger range, you see it. So what we'd like to do is discover that. Go on. Yeah, so when humans trace these things, they're frequently quite good about the number of objects. They might make a few mistakes at branch points, like missing a branch point. But once they've discovered it, they're pretty good about the number of objects. Where they're less reliable is in the precise location of these boundaries. They can be shifted over by a few pixels either way. And so that's the 4 type of mistakes that. That's a good question. So how do you validate this? Is there external validation? So the way that currently we do this is we have, we're looking for consensus. So we have humans trace the block of tissue, and we look to see, to look for consensus. But that's not, there could be systematic errors that creep in because of that. And what you'd like to do is verify it through maybe something like what Ed talked about to make sure that or correlate light microscopy . Absolutely, but that still doesn't, So yes, you do integrate 3-dimensional information. I've shown you here a 2-dimensional cartoon, a small example, but yes. But still, there could be biases, either because of the way structures look and the way that people are interpreting it, or because the labeling sort of has a particular kind of bias in it. So again, you'd like some independent verification. That is a tricky problem. But if you believe what humans say, then that's what we're going for. So this is the kind of location that might lead to a merge error and lead to these 2 processes being connected to each other. The second type of, go on. Question?
A signal going from the thing is abandoned,
So in practice, what does happen is that you have the cell, and it fragments into lots of tiny fragments. And then those fragments get merged onto other neurites. And so all of these errors occur in correlated locations and combine with each other to make segmentations bad. And so we have to fix all of them. The second problem that leads to splits is that we are resolution limited, and so wires can, at certain points, shrink to maybe just 2 or 3 pixels across. And that means if I make a mistake in just those 2 or 3 pixels, that will break that wire. So these images were taken using Winfried Denk's machine, stained using an extracellular label. And the pixel resolution here, this is an older image. It had about 28 nanometers lateral resolution and about 30 nanometers in Z. Newer images, and he'll be here next week, I guess, and he'll tell you about 16 nanometer XY and 12 nanometer XY and and about 20 in Z. But he can fill you in with that. Even if you had better lateral resolution, this sort of thing can happen in Z. When you cut, there's a limit to how thick you can cut things. Okay. So our job is to kind of solve this tracing problem. And this tracing problem is kind of a well-known problem in computer vision. People have been working on this since the 60s. And in computer vision, it's called image segmentation. And here's about 3 different examples of this. On the left is our familiar example with electron micrographs. And we've colored them all different colors, and these are all different cells. On the right, these are photographs. And what we're trying to do is to draw boundaries between the different objects in the scene. And here's a hand labeling generated from a data set known as the Berkeley segmentation data set. Again, you have over here, using fluorescence microscopy, these are some cells that were labeled fluorescently and imaged, and this is what the grand truth looks like. And this might be what you want your segmentation algorithm to give you at the end of the day. There is one way in which, even though all these are examples of the same problem, there is one way in which our problem is more challenging and more difficult. And this has to do with the fact that objects aren't compact. So a large fraction of the errors come from the surface area, the membrane between objects, so the boundaries between objects. And so the more boundary you have to an object, the more locations you have or possibilities you have for making mistakes. So if you have relatively compact objects, the surface area to volume ratio is small. But neurons kind of are exactly the opposite of that. They spread out and they have really long kind of extended processes. And so that gives you many, many more opportunities for mistakes. And it's a 3D problem as opposed to the 2D. So again, the more opportunities you have for mistakes, the lower your error rate needs to be. So it's kind of a really challenging problem. So the way that computer vision, computer scientists have approached this problem is to, one way to do this is to take the image and then to detect local boundaries between objects. And this you can do by looking at either a patch over here or maybe a slightly larger patch or maybe the whole image. But at the end of the day, you're making a decision about this pixel over here. Is that a boundary or is it not? And what that gives you is something that looks like a boundary map right here. And then all you have to do is color it. And when you color it in, then you can create a segmentation that looks like this. And this is the long-range propagation of this local boundary detection. So you want to ignore them because they're not cellular boundaries. So what do we do special about that? So we're using a machine learning algorithm to detect boundaries. What we'd like it to do is to only detect true boundaries between cells and not to be fooled by these intracellular organelles. And that's a machine learning problem. We'd like for the algorithm to be able to distinguish between these two cases. And we train it to do that. Okay, so let me do a kind of a quick review of the ways that people have gone about this. This is one way of kind of categorizing the vast literature over the last 40, 50 years in image segmentation. Back in the 60s, when people first started working on this, they thought, you know, edges have boundaries between objects, probably have very well-defined characteristics. If only we can come up with exactly a description for what boundaries look like, the principles behind this, then we can engineer the right solution. What they came up with were things like gradient filters, Gabor filters, steerable filters, and so on. And the idea is to locally look for sharp boundaries, sharp edges in the image intensity. So if you think of the image as sort of a function in 2D or 3D space, you look for sharp discontinuities there. And people have different filtering approaches to detect these things. Then what they discovered was that either due to noise or due to lighting conditions and so on, locally you may not always be able to determine whether a certain pixel is a boundary pixel or not. Like in the example that I showed you earlier, you actually have to integrate over information from a longer and a larger field of view. What that ended up with was algorithms for propagating local information to do contra-completion. So these are contra-completion type algorithms that give you hallucinate boundaries, such as with Kinesa triangles and so on. Based largely on Gestalt principles, and there was a parallel in visual neuroscience as well, where people decided that lateral interactions can give you this sort of propagation. And examples of this are Markov random fields. This comes from probabilistic generative and graphical models theories. Then there's anisotropic diffusion, normalized cuts, graph cuts. These are all kind of different algorithms for integrating long-range information, local information over long-range ranges. And in both of these, actually, David Heeger has done some very beautiful classic work in both of these types of algorithms. More recently, in the 90s and the 2000s, people have decided that engineering a solution can only take us so far. Every image type is different. Figuring out exactly the right principles behind what makes an edge an edge for every situation is probably very difficult to do. Why don't we collect lots of examples of what segmentations should look like and try to create an algorithm that will automatically adapt the parameters, its parameters to improve segmentation performance. And this is a field known as machine learning, and there's essentially two classes of, again, algorithms there. There's boundary detectors of the local form that have been trained, and there's various versions there. And then there's things like Markov random fields, which I talked about here, which people in principle can train, and yet in practice are intractable. Markov random field type algorithms are combinatorial optimization problems. What that means is that as you increase the size of the image, the amount of computation you need to expend to get an answer from your segmentation algorithm grows exponentially. So there's approximations that people have come up with, but still it's an intractable problem. And what machine learning requires is this iterative optimization. So what you do is you have your algorithm make a prediction, you evaluate it. How well is it doing? Find the mistakes. And then you adjust the parameters to make a small improvement in the performance. And you do this repeatedly, and your performance gets better. But when the inner loop of making a prediction is slow, learning is even slower. And so Markov random field type algorithms, people do try to train them, but when you make the model as complex as we need it to be, learning is basically intractable. So what I'm going to do in this talk is tell you about a new algorithm, a new class of algorithms that we've developed that that really, for the first time, actually solved the image segmentation problem from end to end in a very nice way, and do kind of are exactly so solving the problem. You'll understand that a little bit more as I go along. But let me define, maybe explain what machine learning is again. There's different ways that people talk about it. One is learning from examples. The other, more sort of mechanistic way of thinking about it is you have an algorithm with lots of parameters and you just want to automatically adjust those parameters. You could sit there and adjust them by hand to improve your performance, but the goal here is to do it automatically. And the way you do that is by collecting some data that will tell you what the right answer is and looking for differences between them. Okay, so there's three basic ingredients to any machine learning algorithm. And I'll sort of give you a little tutorial and then go through how we've sort of modified each of these. The first main ingredient is a prediction function. It's an algorithm. This algorithm has parameters in it. And it takes an input, which in our case is the image, and it gives us an output, which in our case is a segmentation or a coloring of all the pixels in the image. That's our algorithm. Now what we'd like is a loss function or a cost function or an error function. And the goal of this function is to tell us how good the prediction that the algorithm made is. And the way it's going to do that is it's going to take the prediction and it's going to compare it with ground truth. And these ground truth in our case is provided by human examples. You compare it and it gives you a score. It tells you how good is this particular prediction. And the goal behind machine learning is to generate an algorithm that allows us to adjust these parameters to minimize the amount of errors that we're making. And this is not always possible. You can construct combinations of prediction functions and loss functions for which you don't know how to minimize them. And so it takes a little bit of effort to try to marry the right cost function and the right prediction algorithm to discover the right way of minimizing it. So I'll first talk about what the prediction algorithm that we use is and why it's a good thing to do. So let's go through that. So again, what we want is this is our input X, this is our prediction Y, and we want some segmentation algorithm that takes this as input and gives us that. So many algorithms and image segmentation algorithms, it's not all, again, can be broken up into two steps. One is computing a boundary map. This is inverted. I'll kind of go back and forth, but basically when it looks binary like this, it's a boundary map generated from this image. And then what we do is we color the insides of it to give you a final segmentation. So as I mentioned, the classic way of applying machine learning that's tractable is to improve the boundary detection. Back in the day, there was no learning here, and you just detected the boundaries. But now what people do is you compute features that you think might be predictive of a boundary. So you may not know exactly how to characterize a boundary, but you may know that that most boundaries have certain features in common. So you compute these features and you design them, and then you combine them using a learning algorithm, using a function approximator, a black box that has knobs in them, and it basically figures out how exactly to optimally combine them to give you an answer. And there's some work along these lines. The one problem here is that if you choose either by accident or if you choose the wrong features, then your performance can suffer. And it can suffer in two ways. One, you could decide to kind of throw a large basket of features at the algorithm. Then it suffers in the sense that now it has to select features amongst this large basket that are actually predictive, and then figure out which ones are useful, which ones aren't, and then try to make a prediction from there. If you make your space too small, then you may be throwing away information already that will never help the and the algorithm will never be able to figure out how to do the right answer. So what we like is to try to, what we'd like to do is to try to learn the features and the combination step. And there's a nice algorithm, nice class of algorithms that we can do there. And so I'll tell you about our method for learning both these things, and with the hope being that if you do that, you're never in at the risk of throwing away data that might be useful, but also you don't have to think too much about the problem. You don't have to be smart enough to come up with these features. All you need is lots of data, examples, and you learn automatically from that data. Okay, so how do we do this? Our workhorse is a type of neural network known as a convolutional network. So this is exactly an artificial neural network invented in the 80s and even before, but generalized to images in a particular way. This type of model is also something that people have used to explain visual processing, and so there's actually direct analogs, analogies that you can draw between a convolutional network and different stages of visual processing in the brain, V1 and so on. And so let me walk you through it. So what we have as the input to the algorithm is an image. In our case, it's a three-dimensional electron micrograph, but over here what I'm showing you is just a 2D plane just for visualization. What you do is you filter it with different filters, and you can think of that filter as being a particular receptive field of a neuron in maybe the retina or some other stage. And by filtering, what you get is a feature map, and that feature map has activations at locations where the filter looks like the image. And what you do then is you run it through a nonlinearity that basically almost sort of binarizes that, so sort of looking for these features. Now what you can do is you can look for many different features. You could look for edges at different orientations, you could look for circles, center surround type features. All of these things are encoded by the filter that's used. And so if you filter the image with many different filters, you get many different feature maps. And again, you can iterate this. So if you imagine that this is V1, you could go to V2 by again filtering these guys with different filters. And what that means is that you have a receptive field here, maybe that's looking at oriented bars in this direction and oriented bars in the other direction, and looking for conjunctions of these things. So you're making higher order features every time you go from one feature map layer to the next layer. And you can iterate this as many times as you want. The parameters in this model are the filters here. And the filters are the receptive fields of each of these neurons. And what we're requiring in a convolutional network is that the filters are translation invariant. So at different places in the retinotopic map, if you think of it in that way, the filters look exactly the same. And what that gives us is a large reduction in parameter space. So we iterate this many times, and then finally we have convergence, and we get an output that's, again, one image. So this is an algorithm. It's a nonlinear filtering algorithm that allows us to go from one image over here to another image at the other end. And lots of people have worked on this. Jan LeCun in particular at NYU, and he did a lot of this work at Bell Labs, has been a huge hugely influential in developing and using these algorithms for digit recognition and so on. There's a few ways in which ours is different, in that we're going from an image to another image. Frequently people in object recognition or character recognition go from an image to a number, which is one number. In our case, we have to create an entire prediction. Okay, so it has all the nice properties of universal function approximation and so on. If you have lots and lots of units, it can learn to do all the nice things that neural networks can. But then, exactly. So you can take this image and you can train it to detect faces in photographs. That's one setting of the parameters, of the filters in this model. You can train it to detect synapses. That's another setting. You can train it to detect boundaries in the image. That's another setting. So the idea is that this is a completely flexible model that will give you different algorithms for different settings of the filters. And what we need now to constrain it and to tell it exactly what computation we want it to do is the training data. Yes? So what we use here is backpropagation learning. So I've shown you this already. We call these guys hidden layers or feature maps because we don't know what they should be. But over here, we know what it should be. So what we're for learning, what we do is we have an input image. We have a desired output image. And we want to train this algorithm such that it produces the desired output. And you can use basically the gradient error backpropagation algorithm to solve this problem. That's an efficient algorithm for doing gradient descent on a function that's the square loss of this.
How many hidden layers do you use in practice?
In practice, we try to go as far as we can before computation, or it gets too slow to train. Right now, we're up to 5 or 6 layers. Actually 6 or 7 layers. Yeah. You could call it that. I call it 3D image processing as opposed to video. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. That's right. Oh, these are all 3D images, and these are all 3D filters. So 3D filtering, so I could take this image, rotate it around, and it would do exactly the same computation.
How does the network know
that
two images are close to each other?
Oh, no, I create a 3D image.
How does it know that 2 pixels are close to each other?
Just the same way you know that 2 pixels are close together in 2D. It's a filter on an image. That's right, yeah. Yes, we do that. Yes, so we try to do that actually. But I didn't mean that in the same way. But yes, we actually do try to impose rotation invariance. But really, what I meant was translation invariance. Yeah. Exactly. That's right. Exactly. Yeah, so it turns out it's a bit of a non-trivial problem, and we have some new work on how to create rotational invariant convolutional networks. And I could talk to you about that. No, we don't do scale invariants because each of these images is imaged at a fixed resolution microscope, and processes have sort of a fixed, so for instance, the boundaries between objects have a fixed scale. And even though the radius, the diameter of a process can vary, the boundaries actually have a fixed scale. And so it doesn't actually make that much sense to do scale invariants, as it would for photographs, which are actually collected at different scales.
So you have to tell your machine what the magnification was, and that's the scale that you use for setting the scale.
Basically, yeah.
So let me suggest.
Okay. Yes, that's a feature space, which.
No, it's actually. You don't have to think of it as a feature space. You can just think of it as a change of basis. So you were to think of it as a Taylor series, spherical filters are just derivatives.
Yeah.
Higher order derivatives in each of 3 dimensions, right? So you know when you get to, as you add each order derivative, you need more of them, right? Taylor's expansion out to, whatever nth derivative you want, and now it's just a change of basis.
So I actually did that.
You can learn your weights on the basis set rather than learning your weights on the basis.
So that was the first thing that I actually did, was to use Sterbill filters. That was about a few years ago. It turns out that there were still problems there, and we could talk about this later. And so what we were trying to do is to learn the basis as well to adapt. But we should talk about it. Yeah. That's right.
There was a C-direction that's different from
Yeah, so we actually, in our case, we only rotate in the XY plane because the cutting plane is different. I'm not sure how much of a difference that actually makes, but I haven't done the experiment of rotating out of plane. So in practice, I only do 2D. So maybe let's think of a 1D convolutional network. So what that would mean is that each of these images, instead of being an image, is just a 1D line, and you could filter. And now, the way I go from 1D to 2D is by using a 2D filter. Any pixel to any pixel. Well, it's a local operation on the image. It's just filtering locally.
So what's the size of your convolution?
So in this case, it's about 5 cube. But every time I do it, I repeat it, the field of view grows because I'm taking little features that are 5 cube features and then combining them to make 11 cube features, 9 cube features, and then 13 cube features, and then so on. And then we get to a large. Yeah, so in practice we actually just do 5 cube, and but you're right that the field of view is slightly anisotropic. Yes? Yeah, so so this is related to what Chuck asked. So training neural networks with many layers is actually a difficult problem. And the difficulty has to do with the fact that there's many local minima in such an architecture. So the biggest problem that we have is actually underfitting because the optimization goes to a local minimum. And so there's now new heuristics that people have developed which have to do with training these one layer at a time and adding one layer at a time. And that helps us solve the underfitting problem to a little bit better, but we're still underfitting. And so the nicest thing about this, and now's a good time to talk about it, is that the number of parameters in this network, let's say this network right here, is about 12,000. And the amount of data that we have is about several million pixels. So if you think of pixels as examples, so we still have a lot more data than we have examples, but the input dimensionality here is also about 12,000. So it should be a little bit surprising that you could get away with just 12,000 parameters for an input vector that's about 12,000 big. And the reason for that is, let's say you have a regular neural network that's operating on this, or support vector machine that's operating on a 12,000 dimensional feature space. What you would require is then a matrix that multiplies it. And that matrix will have as many columns. So each column has a length of 12,000, but it should have as many columns. In practice, they have at least n log n columns there. And it depends on how difficult the classification problem is, but that can grow even greater. So usually, it should be many times 12,000. Maybe 12,000 squared even, and this is far less than that. And the reason we're getting that is because we're exploiting translation invariance at these local patches. And so there's an expression, there's a term in machine learning called sample complexity. This has to do with what's the ratio, how many parameters do you have in your model, and that tells you how much data do you need to constrain them. And this is this type of model is really frugal in its use of parameters, and so the sample complexity is very good compared to an SVM. Or sorry? Exactly. That's the way we get translation invariance. Each of these operations here is just a filtering operation, followed by a nonlinearity that's pointwise, and so that doesn't break the translation invariance. No, it's completely a feed-forward network. The one other thing to say is that this model, let's say I only had one feature map at each of these stages, and I constrained each of these filters to be the same, then that, and if I do this, repeat this for a long period of time, that is exactly the mean field solution to a particular Markov, to a Markov random field. And for whatever Markov random field that you choose, you can do mean field dynamics by doing it that way. So this kind of network is actually slightly more powerful than the mean field of a Markov random field, because we're allowing many different, many more features, feature maps at each layer, but also allowing for the weights to be different at each stage. And so in some sense, it's more powerful, but more tractably trained than a Markov random field, because we've broken the recurrence by taking a recurrent network, unrolling it for a certain number of steps, and then truncating it. Each layer over here, yes, it only looks at, that's right. Not quite scale space. I wouldn't call it scale space, but you're increasing the spatial field of view. That's right. Absolutely. No, but the good news is the resolution. But I'm never downsampling. So the good news is that the resolution of each of these maps is at the resolution of the original image. So I'm never actually. So I could actually be sharpening as I go up. And so I'm not losing high spatial frequency information. Absolutely, that's right. So you could imagine. So in theory, this is a direct. All this needs to be is a directed graph, directed acyclic graph. And so you can add as many links, shortcut links, and so on as you like, and try to train that network. We have tried to do this at various times. It's not clear how much extra benefit that we've gotten from this, but we've done some of these experiments, but the parameter space is large. Okay. So what we did is we trained this. So what we did to train it is we created boundary maps from our segmentations that the humans have made, and then we gave it input image over here. That's the raw EM image. An output image over there, that's the boundary map. And we trained it to minimize the number of pixel misclassification errors. That's a local measure, what we did. I'll tell you later what the better thing to do is. You can measure training and test set errors. What you see here is that there isn't that much overfitting, training set and test set. Aren't wildly different, but a better way to visualize this is to use a precision recall curve, which tells you, it's kind of from search engine methodology, what it means is, let's say you do a search for boundary pixels, and then you make a list of all of the pixels based on confidence, how many of the top hits are actually boundary pixels, and then how many aren't, and so on. So it's a measure of that. And it's a classic measure, which really, you wouldn't know what to make of it. So for contrast, I'll tell you this is a data set, completely different data set. It's actually photographs. And this is something that computer vision people have worked on for about, at this point, probably about 10 years. And the best possible algorithms do over here. A better algorithm is one that goes closest to that corner right there. Our performance is a lot better. But of course, it's a different data set. It's probably more challenging. You can't really compare these things. But for those that know this, this is the Berkeley segmentation data set. This is human performance there. And we're doing better. Sorry? Yeah, so the reason is that compared to photographs, in natural images and photographs, humans don't frequently agree on what's an object and what's a partitioning of an object. There's a lot of ambiguity that's kind of more basic ambiguity that has to do with if I take a photograph of you, do I chop up the arms separately from your shirt, separately from your head, or do I kind of put them together? And there's over-refinements and under-refinements and so on. There can be a lot of variability between humans. They may not even agree on what constitutes an object. Whereas in our case, everything is really well posed. We know what objects are. We know that there's neurons, and our humans are much more reliable. So we should be able to do better, and we are. Yes. So it's pixel-wise mistakes. So I look at pixels that should be boundaries and aren't, pixels that shouldn't be boundaries and are. And so I just look at it. That's right, exactly. Okay, so the good news is that this architecture can learn its own features and didn't make any assumptions about the data set. So I could just as easily run it on video, which is 3D, and I could train it just by changing the parameters to do a different task. What that means is that it can adapt from one staining technique to another. Any single network, once I've trained it, is only good for that particular kind of data set. But the meta algorithm, that's the learning algorithm, that's more general. And I can, because I haven't made any assumptions, I can use it anywhere. There's these theoretical properties like universe, but in practice, no finite network ever is. So this, you can believe it if you're a theorist and care about such things, but it's not that. The bad is that we still have a lot of parameters. It's not one or two parameters. It's about 10,000 to a million parameters. That's a lot of parameters. What that means is that we need more training data than you would if I had already restricted the feature space to just 10 numbers. So lots more training data, but that's not that hard to get. It's cheaper for us to get training data than it is to reconstruct everything by hand. And so we're able to expend the effort of German undergraduates in Winfried Denk's lab to do this, because we don't have to do it ourselves. The other bad news is theoretical. There are lots of local minima when you have to learn both the features and the way to combine them. Many algorithms that do that have local minima in them. There's a couple of technical ways of getting around that. You can use stochastic gradient descent, which practice can get you out of the local minima. And then there's more, this is an active area of research, so there's lots of new optimization methods for getting better performance. But in the end, you don't care about getting the global minimum, because that's not really what you care about. You care about getting a minimum that gives you good performance. And as long as you can get there, that you've succeeded. Yes? So there is this idea of a generative model, which is a model that can generate pictures that you're looking at. And then there's the idea, and so if you had a good generative model, then you can try to invert that. There's an alternate school of thought which says the way to do machine learning is to do it discriminatively. It may be that to generate everything, generating the color of the object, the texture inside, all of that is completely useless, because all you need to do is recognize boundaries for your task. And so maybe you could do that with even fewer parameters. And there's this tension between the two approaches, and people sometimes try to integrate them and do semi-supervised learning, where they do some amount of learning of the generative model, but also discriminative learning. And so there's algorithms of various flavors. In practice, if you have enough data, where enough is sort of vaguely defined, a discriminative model usually does better, because it can get away with fewer parameters. All you need to do is to be able to model the parameters that are diagnostic to your task. You don't need to model everything else. Okay, so what I didn't talk about yet is how do I group once I've made this boundary map, how do I generate these colorings? So the way to do that is there's a simple algorithm called connected components, and the idea is simple. So what you do is here's a toy example. Here's an image with a boundary running through it. Let's say I got something that looked like this from the output of my boundary detector. It detected a boundary right in the middle. Then the interpretation is simple. All I do is I color this side one color, color that side another color. Frequently, what might happen is that you have a gap here. And when that happens, then you can't. Then the interpretation is that this should be one object separated by a bottleneck like this. Of course, people in the literature argue about what you should do here. They say, well, maybe you should do contracompletion and so on. And this leads to the types of algorithms that I talked about earlier that try to propagate information across this gap. And there's things like normalized cuts, graph cuts. Again, they're slow. The fast connected components makes no assumptions here. These guys have to make assumptions about what boundaries should look like so they know when to contour complete and when to not. And anytime you make assumptions and those assumptions are wrong, your algorithm will fail. And we've tried these things and they don't work well. In fact, just doing connected components with our boundary map works good. But still, we've gotten a nice architecture that gives us good results that beats other algorithms, but it's still not good enough. So lots of errors still remain, and why? And how do we fix that? So this was where we were about 2 years ago. We had these nice architectures that learned their own features and combined them. We thought, okay, we thought of everything. There is one thing that we still have not thought about properly, and that's the loss function to use. So the loss function that we used was simple pixel-wise error, so the classification of pixels into boundaries and not boundaries. Turns out, not so good. So let's explain why. So here's the toy example again. What we'd like to get is this. In practice, what we get is something that looks like this or this. If we just look at the pixel error difference, pixel differences between here, this makes three mistakes, three pixels. This, on the other hand, makes five mistakes. And yet, this guy is actually what we want, because this actually separates this into two objects, even though it's making more pixel mistakes. The guy on the left, fewer mistakes, but this guy, this one mistake over here is particularly damning. And so so what that tells us is that it's maybe our loss function that's the wrong function. And it could be driving us into this situation where we're making more mistakes that matter to us, but fewer mistakes in terms of absolute pixel numbers. So how do we come up with a better idea? A better loss function. So it turns out we don't have to think too far. People have thought about this a little bit. They just didn't know how to train it. So let's see. Yeah, I already said that. Okay, so we go back to thinking about pixel segmentation, image segmentation as a pixel coloring problem. Another way to think about that is as a clustering problem, where you have a bag of pixels. What you'd like to do is cluster each pixels into little groups, little baglets that correspond to different objects. So so now once you've done that, once you've clustered these pixels the right way, then you have a good segmentation. So when you think of it that way, you can apply some metrics that have come from clustering theory, which tell you how well are you clustering the object. And one classic measure is the RAND index. So the RAND index, what it does is it just looks at pairs of pixels. So you look at pairs of pixels and you say, this pair of pixels, in my ground truth data set, in my labeling, they should have been part of the same object. Are they part of the same object in my prediction? If they're different, that's a mistake. And you do the opposite, two pair of pixels that should be in different objects, and if I connect them, meaning they're part of the same object, again, a mistake. So you count up the number of pixel pairs that you get wrong, and that's a RAND error, a RAND index. And it was proposed in about 1970s when people first started thinking about clustering, but people have since then started applying it to image segmentations and so on. And what you could do is you can make this pixel connectivity matrix for each segmentation. For the ground truth, you make something that looks like this. It looks block diagonal, and each of these blocks has a value of 1, and that means that all of those pixels correspond to the same object. And then the off diagonals have a value of 0, that meaning that pixel pairs that look like that are disconnected, meaning they have different objects. And so when you compare two such pixel connectivity matrices, which are symmetric, the places where they disagree are the places where there's mistakes. And so over here, what's happened is that one object 1 and object 2 got merged into object 1 prime. And you see that those pixels got merged together. And again, over here, this object got split into 2, 3 prime and 4 prime. And again, you can see that there's any place where these two don't match up, those are mistakes. Nice thing about this is that, let's say I just extend a process by 1 pixel. That doesn't really change anything, just changes it. the objects are still the same, I just increased it by one pixel. That would be counted as a pixel error in the original measure. But over here, it has a negligibly small mistake because it's basically just an edge of this square. Whereas if I take that exact same pixel error and I put it somewhere in the middle of an object, that's a really bad mistake. And what that will do is that will give you a balanced error that has to do with the area of the two sub-objects multiplied together. And so this has some nice properties in terms of weighing object errors in the middle of objects a lot higher than object error, pixel errors at the ends. So when you do that over here, what you'll discover is that this guy has huge rand errors because both of these off-diagonal blocks you've gotten wrong because you've merged all pixels on either side. Over here, you've made a few more pixel errors, but your rand index is still pretty good. And so if you look at the numbers, this is 50% of your pixel pairs you've gotten wrong. Over here, only two. So this is a nice measure. It tells us exactly, it's sort of measuring segmentation performance as opposed to pixel errors on the boundary. So that's good. What we still need to figure out is how do we train our network to optimize this error? It's actually hard because the rand index makes no reference to the boundaries at all. It only talks about pixel pairs. All it's saying is that there's got to be a boundary somewhere between a particular pixel pair that should be disconnected. It doesn't tell you where. And there's a very non-trivial dependence. Going from the boundary map to segmentation is highly nonlinear and has lots of long-range interactions and so on. So it's a credit assignment problem that we have to solve, but one that's very challenging. And people have thought about this for a long time and not quite come up with an answer. And so we have an answer to this that, like all good answers, is actually in hindsight rather simple. To explain, and so let me explain the flavor of that. And so now we come to the last part, which is how do we minimize the loss function? How do I train these parameters over here in the boundary detector, the filters, and my convolutional network, such that I minimize the rand error instead of pixel error, which we already knew how to do for a long time. Okay, so here's an example of an image. Again, SPIFSIM image from Winfried Denk's lab. Here's a boundary prediction that was made by a convolutional network that was trained in the way that I told you about earlier. Pixel error training. Okay, so places, so what we'd like is for boundaries to be really dark and the insides of objects to be really bright. And any place where this boundary looks indistinct, kind of gray, is a potential location of a merge error. So what would happen is once I take this and I threshold it, and make it binary, a binary 0-1 image, and do connected components on it, then I'll find that these guys will merge. Okay, so what we need to do for the rand index is we need to look at pixel pairs. We need to say that this pixel pair across here should be disconnected, and this pixel pair over here should be connected, and do this for all possible pixel pairs in this image. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to tell you the condition under which this pixel pair would be connected and be part of the same object. And the way to do that is actually to take this analog grayscale probability map and to look at it slightly differently. So what you can do is take this and look at the probability of being a boundary as a height function. And color it topographically, so it forms kind of a topographic map. Then you notice that these places, these location of merge errors, if you think of these guys as land masses, each of these objects, and separated by these ravines or water bodies, what you notice is that locations of merge errors look like, and you zoom in, you notice that these guys look like land bridges or isthmuses that are merging these land masses. And what you want to do is to burn these bridges. You want to cut them off. So what your learning algorithm needs to do is to find these locations where these bridges are and then cut them off. And then in other places where you need to connect objects up, it needs to build bridges between those land masses. Okay, so how do we do that? So let's characterize what constitutes a land bridge. So it turns out that there's a particular kind of shortest paths computation that you can do on this image, which will exactly locate these land masses. So what is that? So imagine that you consider this pixel pair over here. Sorry, these circles should be right on top of each other. What you do is you look at all possible paths between those two pixels. So paths that look like this, paths that go around, maybe even loop around, but all possible paths. And for every path, you measure its goodness by the height of its lowest point. So you take the values, the pixel values along that, and you take the minimum value along those paths. And so those would be these points right here. So those are the lowest pixels. And now, of each of these paths, we then rank them all by which path has the highest low point. And that would be this guy right here, right? So we look at the lowest paths and then we take the highest low. And that means we look at the min along the path and we take the max over paths. And that's something we call the maximin pixel. And that's now the score for that pixel pair is this maximin value of that path. So now the claim is, and this is sort of easy to see now, is that these two pixels are connected if and only if the height of that maximin pixel is above the threshold that you're using to binarize. So what that means, so each of these paths, it gets broken when you binarize it, and you're trying to, and you're an ant and you're following it. It would get broken if I binarize at a certain threshold, and that threshold is the minimum value along that point. So the path that's going to survive the longest as I'm bringing the water level up from low to high is this maximin path. And if I break that path, then these two pixels will never be connected. But as long as that path has survived, these two pixels will be connected. So what that means is the two pixels are connected if and only if this maximin location is above the threshold. So that's a characterization of the connectivity of pixel pairs. So what we're going to do is exploit that to create a learning algorithm. It's pretty simple, but it actually comes from looking at things as minimum spanning trees over a graph. And so once you look at minimum spanning trees over a graph, it turns out that the maximum paths are along the minimum spanning tree of this graph. They're the unique path between two points along the minimum spanning tree, and the minimum spanning tree can be broken at the weakest link. And so, yeah. So that much of graph theory is actually fairly straightforward. So now what we did was we exploited that to create a learning algorithm. So what we did, so we had this loss function that looked at the pixel connectivity matrices and subtracted them. Now what we can do is we can stick in, instead of the pixel connectivity matrix, we can put in the maximum value between these two points. And what we want is for the maximum value to be close to 1, high, if the two pixels should be connected. And then we want it to be low if the two pixels should be disconnected. So that gives us our iterative learning algorithm. So what we do is we can take the gradient of this guy, because this is kind of a piecewise continuous function right here. And what it does is that for every pair of pixels, it selects one pixel. And so what you try to do is you take the maximum value and you try to push it down. You take a gradient step to push it down if they should be disconnected, that pixel pair. Push it up if they should be connected. So now we have a way of doing exact gradient descent on the RAND index. And that's a nice thing to have. Okay, so the learning algorithm, stochastic gradient descent, you sample pixel pairs, you find the maximum point, and then you either raise it or push it up. Yes, so it can be degenerate. The maximum pixel can be degenerate. At that point, you can select either of them, and that's fine, because you would want to move both of them anyway, or the set of them anyway. So you'll do this over and over. The maximum location will change over time as the parameters adapt. And so that's not a problem. Okay, so that's the algorithm, and I woke up one day to get a draft from Sebastian back for the paper, and he called it malice, which I'm not sure how I feel about the algorithm, but that's the name. And this is an algorithm now for doing end-to-end learning of image segmentation. In fact, I would call it the first tractable algorithm for doing this. And so, yeah, it's a nice thing to have. Yes, it turns out that's another beautiful thing that we lucked out on. Just the same way that connected components is fast and efficient and you could do it in linear time, the minimum spanning tree algorithm can be done in n log n time. And so this kind of finding the maximum path and the maximum location can be done in n log n time, which is basically pretty darn fast. And actually, you can make it even faster. It's quasi-linear, actually, in practice. Yes, so every time you update, the parameters change and the height function will change, and so you'll have to recompute this. So that's what actually makes this slower than the old loss. But in some sense, that was to be expected because we're trying to solve a correlated structured prediction problem. And so we actually need to make a prediction that is a segmentation. We can't just predict locally. We have to look at global consequences of these local mistakes. So that means we have to look globally. Yes.
How long does it take to run this algorithm?
Once I've trained it, running it is linear time. So this is basically the fastest algorithm that you can think of. And I can train it. And it's because of the fact that it's fast that I can train it. But it's really a fast algorithm. Competitors are usually n squared at best, but in practice are far worse than that. And so this algorithm is really really quite simple and fast, really compared to other algorithms. Training takes longer, and it depends on how many layers you have in your convolutional network. When I trained the 6-layer network, that took about 9 months on a couple of CPUs. It's not easy to parallelize. But now we have these graphics processors, and so now I can train the same thing in a couple of days to a week. Simple experiments that we do for papers just to show the differences between the algorithms, that we can do in an hour or so. So that's not too bad. The 9-month project was kind of long, but we have really robust code. So you could turn off the machine and restart it later anytime you want to. It'll recover well. Okay. So the results, you get boundary maps now that are far better. You don't see any of these mergers. No more bridges, so that's good. Okay, you can quantify these in different ways. Here's the fraction correct for training test sets. Really, again, you should look at it using precision recall or rock curve methodology. But again, all of these numbers kind of depend on the size of your data set and the exact network that you've trained. In practice, we use networks that are a lot bigger and data sets that are a lot bigger. So I wouldn't put too much stock in these numbers except to note the relative difference between the two algorithms. In blue is the boundary train network. Now I'm doing precision recall over pixel pairs, not single pixels. And again, the green is far better than the blue. So we've got a better algorithm. that's all you can kind of tell from this. Again, you can quantify it slightly differently, looking at splits and mergers per process, and this makes fewer split and merger mistakes. Absolute numbers, again, I wouldn't look at. One thing that we get for free by trying to solve image segmentation and trying to learn image segmentation as opposed to boundary detection is this. Malice cares about regions and not exactly about the boundaries because you care about the pixel pairs that are on the interiors of objects. You could displace the boundaries and it would still be fine because you've separated the objects mostly right. So here's a toy example to show what I mean. Here's an image and I'd like to separate it into two objects right here. So I want to find the boundary somewhere here. Now, let's say you have a sloppy tracer, and this is related to the question asked earlier. And your tracings kind of have a little bit of displacement in where the boundaries were drawn between these two objects. And this is something, this is a daily fact of life. You will never get a boundary that lines up perfectly with the thing, because in practice, the images don't have distinct boundaries. They will have blurry boundaries, and you don't quite know exactly where to place the boundary. So here's a sort of extreme example of that. And so what I've done is I've trained a network to detect the boundary and to detect the boundary based on this particular labeling. And when I do it, when I train it using pixel error and then do a segmentation, it looks like crap. And that's because most of these examples are actually completely mislabeled. This pixel is not a boundary pixel, and yet in the labeling it says it's a boundary pixel, and neither is this. In fact, it's only right at 3 pixels about where the boundary is. But when you train exactly the same using exactly the same training set, but using maximin learning or malice, what you get is exactly the answer that you want. That's because what malice cares about is separating this region from that region at whichever place the algorithm thinks is the best place to put it. It gives the algorithm a bit of slop in terms of deciding where to put it, and that results in good segmentations at the end. Further, what that means is that you may not actually need to create training data that is fully labeled. You may not have to paint all the pixels in that object on either end of it. Maybe you just need to paint a few over here and a few over here, and just say that these two should be disconnected somewhere along the path. And when you do that, malice actually succeeds. So that should help you make the tracings, the manual tracing problem, and creation of ground truth a lot sort of faster. That means you can get away with sloppy, maybe even disconnected points that you've just labeled as the same object, kind of seed points and so on. Creating the ground truth training set is a very expensive, time-consuming process. So any way that you can speed it up will help. And this comes about because we're training to do image segmentation. So a lot of these things, if I had given you this, you would know exactly what to do and how to segment this. And so we'd like to make the algorithm also know that. This training set has no boundary pixels labeled at all. So it has to figure it out on its own. Exactly the same algorithm. Okay, so where am I? So just to wrap up malice, so what we have now is these words, a little bit ambitious, and take it with a grain of salt, but I feel good saying it. It's the first exact algorithm for doing end-to-end learning of image segmentation that's tractable. And so this is actually a major advance, not just for reconstructing the kinds of neural circuits that we care about, but for any image segmentation problem, such as the problems that I talked about earlier, you can apply this algorithm. So it's kind of good not just for our sort of very specialized problem. I haven't made any assumptions about the data set, so I can generalize this. Linear time segmentation, as you asked. I can actually generate a hierarchy of segmentations. So, and I'll talk about it a little bit later, in n log n time. So that's pretty good. N log n is one of these things that I can actually make this in practice linear, so it's not a worry at all. Doesn't require precise boundary labeling, so that helps speed up the thing. And the theory of how it works is by learning to doing learning on these special distances called ultrametric distances. So what I'll spend the next 10 minutes doing is just explaining a little bit of the theory, and then wrap up. If you have any questions about the algorithm, maybe I'll take them now. Great, okay. Here's some theory. Image segmentation is a hard structured prediction problem. What do I mean by that? What that means is that you have a classifier. Normally classifiers give you one output or two outputs or whatever. Maybe they're trying to say, is this pixel grass or not grass? Is this the digit 2 or is it 1? In image segmentation, you have your input is an image, your output is another image. If you think of it, that's a lot of numbers. And the result of those numbers are actually correlated. So what I mean is that let's say I take a boundary and I displace it over by 1 pixel. That is not a bad thing in my view. But let's say I just erase one of those pixels. That is a really bad thing. So in terms of comparing these two output vectors, one of them is very different from the other. What that means is that the output numbers that you get out have lots of correlations between them that you need to preserve in a very special way. So that's what people mean by structured prediction. So it's a problem that you're not supposed to be able to solve in an easy way. But the way that we've solved this is by developing a new family of algorithms for learning something called ultrametric distances. Let me tell you a little bit about what an ultrametric distance is. This part is a little bit of a twister kind of thing. So it's okay if ask me questions if it seems kind of counterintuitive. In mathematics, a distance function is one that takes as input two points in space, two vectors, two numbers, and then gives you a scalar value output. So over here, here's a distance function that has two inputs and gives you an output. Okay. And then there's these things called metric distances, which are called metric distances if they satisfy three properties. And the Euclidean metric distance that we think of in everyday life, distance between two points, is one that satisfies these things. So you can think of that in your head when you think of these things. So the properties are distance between a point and itself is zero. That sort of makes sense. Points are right on top of each other. Distances have to be non-negative. You can't have negative distances between two points. Also makes sense. And finally, you have the triangle inequality. The triangle inequality is a good one. So what that says is that if you look at this triangle over here, and you look at this distance and this distance over here, if I try to fold it out, and you look at this triplet of points, the largest that this point, this distance over here can be is the sum of these two distances. And that's achieved when you take this triangle and you fold it out and put all three points on a line, right? So that's when you get when you reach the bound. But it always has to be less than that bound. It can be, and in this case, it's less than that. So Euclidean distance actually satisfies all these properties. An ultrametric is a distance is a metric distance, but it has a stronger version of the triangle inequality. So what that means is that this third distance over here can be at most the max of either of these two things. It can't be larger than the larger of these two distances. It has some counterintuitive properties. What it means is that none of the triangles in this space can be obtuse in this form, and they all have to be isosceles, because if I take this triangle inequality and permute and relabel these guys, what I'll discover is that two of these edges have to have the same length. And those two edges are usually greater than in length than the third edge. So that's the topology or the properties of an ultrametric space. So what does that really mean though? How do you visualize this? Well, it turns out that there's a one-to-one mapping between ultrametric distances and hierarchies or dendrograms or hierarchical clusterings even. So the way is this. So you take all your points that you're interested in, and you put them at leaf nodes of this tree. And now you create a tree, and the distance between any two points is the height of its earliest ancestor, common ancestor. So for any of these points, so this point and that point, the ancestor is right here. This point and that point, I might have to go all the way up the tree. So those are the distances. So the distances are constrained in a weird way. And you can see the triangle inequality here. Now let's say I have the distance between x and y, and then I have the distance between, let's say, this point z over here and y. Well, x and y and z and y are the same because you have to go up to the same distance. And for any sort of subtree that you look at, you'll discover that the ultrametric axioms kind of hold true. So tree distances are ultrametric. But what you really get from this is clustering. So ultrametric distances sort of naturally cluster. What that means is that if I am close, meaning close in terms of some radius, to Stephen over here, and Stephen is close in some sense to Chuck over here, I have to be close to Chuck also. I can't be far away from Chuck. So points kind of have to cluster because you can't have these obtuse triangles, which in Euclidean spaces you can have. So when you have balls, these balls, so this part is a little bit for more for mathematicians. So if you draw a ball, you can't have partial overlap of balls where you have one point that's only in one of these balls and not in the other. So you can either have no intersection at all or complete intersection in the sense that they both overlap completely. So points cluster tightly in this way and exclude. You don't have soft clustering and this sort of thing. And so the way to think about this and bring it back to where we are is to think of each of these leaf nodes as a pixel in the image. And what happens is as you change the water level, let's say you start the water level really high where all the landmasses are submerged, then all these pixels are completely separate and they're their own objects. And as you lower them, they'll start to merge and agglomerate into landmasses. And as that's happening, this is the tree that sort of represents the merging process. And if you lower the water level all the way to zero, then finally all the objects will be connected over here. And that's sort of a representation of the hierarchy in pixel space, but also a representation of the hierarchy in object space. So let's say here's an object and here's an object, but really they should have been connected. What that means is, if I lower this threshold, then I can merge this. Yes?
You haven't said anything yet over the last hour about how you then choose that threshold.
Ah, yes. So because I'm using a classifier, I set it at, it's just like a classification problem for a neural network. So I use a loss that sets it to be 0.5. But really, in the end, what I do is I look at the training set and look at the threshold that minimizes the RAND index, and I just use that. But in practice, what I'm trying to say here is that you can set it at one threshold, but when you're doing proofreading, which is what we need to do because we still have mistakes in it, you can figure out local changes in this threshold can help suggest.
From that picture, it doesn't seem as though you can necessarily get rid of a single value.
Well, we've trained it to be a single value. We've trained, so what we're doing, let's see, do I have another slide? Our goal in the learning algorithm is to push incorrect connections in this dendrogram down to zero, and to push correct connections all the way up to one. That's our goal. That's what we've been learning. What we've been learning, these junctions over here are actually those maximum pixels. And so our learning is actually trying to drive these guys up and drive them down, depending on whether they should be connected or not. And so our goal is to create a margin over here. And this is the margin of the classifier for the pixel pair connectivity. So just the same way that in classic classification theory, you have to pick a threshold for where to binarize a continuous value, you have to do the same thing here. And whether or not that works depends on how well separated your classes are. And so this is basically the same as traditional classification. Is that?
Yeah.
Okay. But what I'm saying now is that you can exploit this hierarchy to suggest splits and mergers. Let's say you look at an object and it looks like crap. There's something wrong. It's either got mergers in it or splits in it. And you want to figure out what to do. This tree is a map that tells you which potential, if I change the threshold locally, what its potential partner could be. And so I can use that to suggest to a human proofreader which objects surrounding it could maybe have been merged in. And that sort of thing is hugely useful because then you don't have to go hunting. In Neuropil, an object can have thousands, tens of thousands of partners that are right next to it, neighbors. And if you have to go hunting there to find where the branch point, which of these could have connected to this, that's a hugely hard problem. But if you have suggestions, then that helps the problem. So we have to try. So what we're doing now is we're building a 3D tool to explore segmentations, this segmentation tree, not in the form of this sort of visualization, but in a three-dimensional space where you have an object in the center and it tells you, gives you suggestions about which other objects are right next to it in ultrametric space, according to the ultrametric nearest neighbor, and that helps you sort of piece these things together. Currently crashes a bit, so I don't have a demo, but that's the idea. Yeah. Yeah, so actually, yes, and the precision recall curves that I showed you earlier are basically a visualization of that. Is to look at which of these branch points as a function of pixel pairs, the ordering of them, and how which of them are right and which of them are wrong. That's right. So in practice, we select one, but really what you want is to select the one that makes your proofreading the easiest. And so with the proofreading tool, what you want to do is to play around with that and experimentally. Or somewhere intermediate, because you can actually split and merge with the tool. So it wouldn't go to an extreme. Okay, so one way of doing this is to visualize it and to see if it's if it looks like it's a fragment that should be connected to something. So you go to the tips and you figure out who should it be connected to. The other way is mergers. Again, if you see a tree, much like the visualizations that I showed you earlier, if you notice that two processes have kind of merged in a weird way, that you can tell right away just by looking at the 3D rendering. And frequently, you can even kind of localize it very easily by eye. But this tool will tell you how it can break things up. Yeah. Yeah, so that's a harder one. That's a harder one to get to. And the hope is that by looking at the large scale branching structure, you can maybe figure out what that is. But there is no way to catch an error like that without inspecting manually every branch point in the original image. So I think the game we're playing here is to try to reduce the errors as much as possible in the order of ease of addressing these mistakes, and to try to only keep the hard mistakes for later. And so to the extent to which such mistakes happen, which require, I mean, they're going to be rare, right? That's a very peculiar set of conditions. So to the extent to which those happen, they will require more proofreading time. Yes? That's right. That's right.
Do you think that if you were to have an observer find the same amplitude, the segmentation, make a connectivity matrix, and then you use the same kind of algorithms to use that as your ground truth, the connectivity matrix, would that be easier or harder?
Yeah. So in principle, you might think, all I need is the connectivity matrix. I have soma that I put seeds in. And I say that I need to connect them up to these synapses. In practice, that's not enough training data. So you need to give the algorithm a little bit more of a hint in terms of where to, where the wires should go in order to connect the soma to the synapse and the other soma to the synapse as well, and so on. So you can't go to the ultra sparse limit of the toy example that I showed and only put seeds in. Yeah, so I suspect that once we have better models of this, that might be possible, but it's not yet practical. Okay. Yes, absolutely. I mean, absolutely. If you knew that these two should be connected and they're not, absolutely.
The problem you run into with comparing the cluster is that you've got a huge number of pixels on the 3D model. You can't compare every possible combination. So the connectivity matrix will tell you about something about which pixels are the ones that really matter, because they're the ones that lead to a wire being convenient.
Yes, absolutely. So I think I don't know if I can use. I mean, in theory, I can throw it into the learning algorithm and talk about which pixel pairs should be connected. In practice, I think this would be of more use to the proofreader in terms of saying that these two guys should be connected, and if they're not, it's a good way of evaluating. The problem is that the amount of information contained in the connectome is very limited in terms of compared to the segmentation that needs to be generated.
There's a lot of information, though, because you can use it locally. You don't have to say this soma is hooked to that. You can just have to say that this dendrite is hooked to the
absolutely. So that you can use. That you can use. Absolutely. Absolutely. And that is the form of the labeling that we have, is that this dendrite is connected to that other piece. But if you just knew that these two soma are connected and have a synapse somewhere, that's a little bit harder because the search space is a lot bigger. But once you get to the human proofreader, it's a good way of validating, certainly. Maybe we can train a little bit with that too. We have metrics like that we can use, but. So I'm basically done. The nice things about ultrametrics, going back to that, this family of algorithms we can use to solve a lot of other machine learning problems in computer science rather than just image segmentation, we think. And so one of the things we're doing is kind of building on this space of metrics, which are completely different from Euclidean distances, to try to see where in machine learning they might be applicable. In fact, I mean, they're applicable anytime your data has a tree structure to it or a hierarchy, taxonomies of documents and so on frequently have tree structure to them. So there's domains that where this might apply, things like classification, clustering, document retrieval, just like Google works. This might be another way of trying to solve these problems. And then again, there's image segmentation. So we're kind of exploring these other options as well. So it's nice that connectomics has led us to something that could maybe even be more broadly useful. But as far as connectomics, a few things that are on the horizon here. We can improve the performance without thinking about it too much just by getting more training data and training larger models, which will take longer to train. And so what that has to do then is with speeding up our algorithms, running them on fast graphics hardware and parallelizing it and so on. What we're developing now is nice tools for proofreading, like I mentioned. But ultimately what we want is to nicely integrate all three of these things so that we have one program that we can send to each of your labs, and you can generate your own training data with it just by tracing some neurons, and then train the algorithm and then do proofreading with it. And I think we're not quite there yet, but I think probably in a couple of years we'll be there. And so I will conclude with it's a video that's certainly not as exciting as Steven's. It was made a few years ago by a graduate student, Varun Jain, who's extraordinarily talented. And he made this for a talk that Sebastian gave at Neuroscience a few years ago. So Varun is this great, he's an amateur DJ, and he's got great taste in music. Unfortunately, his tastes in music were overruled by Sebastian. So the soundtrack you're about to hear, feel free to ignore it, but it was chosen by Sebastian, not Varun. So here it is. This is a block of tissue about 60 microns big on a side, imaged using Winfried Denk serial block face scanning electron microscopy technique. This is taken from the inner plexiform layer of the retina. What you're seeing, the circles are, of course, the objects. It was stained using the extracellular stain that Winfried has been using for a few years. And what you're seeing are reconstructions of some of these processes. All the processes are reconstructed simultaneously, but showing it at a single time would be difficult to see. So we're showing you one at a time. Sorry? So there aren't spines per se in these cells, but I think there's little swellings that you see where the mitochondria are for various reasons. This is using the old algorithm. So this is using the first part that I talked about with pixel error, not using malice. So we need to make a newer video using the new segmentations, which are a lot better. Yeah, this. That's right. That's right. So this is from Blade Runner. So this is a sparse sampling of all the neurons that have kind of gone from one end to the other. About 60 microns cubed. 60 cubed. 60 on the side. So that's the, thank you. If you have questions, I'll take that.